Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, a Thursday edition here on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for joining. Ian Sher will be along a little bit later. You know, he talks to us from time to time, and he is a writer and editor at CNET. And there's a lawsuit now in California where a guy who was injured in an accident caused by a distracted driver is suing Apple. The idea is that Apple makes the iPhone. The woman who hit him was using an iPhone, and so Apple is responsible. That's one of the things we'll talk with Ian about. And also, you know, we had scheduled to talk to the people from Waverly Labs last week, Andrew Ochoa, and had a bit of a mix-up. So we're going to talk to him about these earpieces that you can put in, and it instantly deciphers, translates foreign languages. We're going to start, though, with School Choice Week. This is School Choice Week, and the National Marketing Director for that week is on a phone line now. Shelby Doyle, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so this is a business show. Why is school choice important for business?
Well, fundamentally, it's important for the future strength of our workforce as a country. Education is really the building block for a successful workforce and a successful economy. So really, education is kind of the foundation of what makes business work in this country.
What is it that School Choice Week is about? And I ask that in a way because it seems like when it comes that you're advocating or speaking on behalf of all sorts of different sorts of forms, even in some ways, choices among public education schools. So what is the advocacy about here?
You're exactly right that for us, school choice spans the entire breadth of the spectrum of schools that exist in this country, from traditional public schools to public charter schools, public magnet schools, online academies, private schools, and homeschooling. And all six of those different types participate in the week in the thousands. And so what we do at National School Choice Week is shine a spotlight on the breadth of options that exist during this week and try to connect parents with schools in their community that they may be interested in, and also make sure that they have the information they need about what options are available to
I'm trying to understand the motivation a little bit. I hope you'll forgive me. But so because it's not like you're just a homeschool advocate or a charter school advocate or a school voucher advocate. You're all united, and the teachers' unions in this country would say that you're kind of united against them, that you're for anything but that. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'd say that, you know, more than 2,000 traditional public schools are celebrating the week with us this year because we have nothing against a traditional public school. And in fact, school choice will always include traditional public schools as probably the most common choice that parents will make for their students.
Is there
Well, open enrollment in traditional public schools is a huge part of the school choice movement. And we've seen lots of traditional school districts sort of open their minds to this idea. And in 10 states around the country, for instance, you can enroll your student in any traditional public school in the state, regardless of district. That's just one way that I think school choice works for public schools.
Yeah, I do worry about it a little bit, and I'm conflicted with it, Shelby, to be honest with you, because obviously my kids could have had a choice to go to a parochial school or public school. They had very good public schools, and so I was lucky in that way, and I think others should have choices as well, obviously. I am concerned that if you give so many kids in struggling school districts a choice out, that we end up leaving a lot of kids behind and schools that will be even more failing. Is that a legitimate concern, and how do you answer to that?
Well, I certainly understand that concern, and I think it's a fair one to have. The last thing we want to do is make a struggling school struggle more. But the good news is that that's not what school choice does. The empirical studies that have been done on areas where additional school choice has been introduced have shown that the traditional district schools in that area get better when choice is available. So even students who aren't directly participating in choice and leaving a school get a better education at that school they've stayed in when choice is available.
So the idea is that public education should be at its base equal for everyone. And when some kids are being allowed out or getting government help to get out to better schools, those at the lesser schools suffer. But you're saying that there's evidence that those lesser schools improve as well.
That's exactly right. Yes. So that study was produced by EdChoice last year. I think it's really important because I have heard that concern before, and I think it's fair. Of course, we don't want to leave anyone worse off, but I think it's important that people know that that's not the future of school choice, that it really does sort of raise all boats with its rising tide.
So Betsy DeVos is likely to be the next education secretary under President Trump. She's a big advocate for all of this, for school choice and such. How much do you think the federal education system is going to change under her?
You know, that's a great question. I think it's one a lot of people are asking. I expect that schools will continue to be sort of run at the state and local level as they always have been. Of course, you know, there's not a lot of telling when it comes to the Trump administration. but I expect that, you know, for the most part, things will continue as they have. States really have a surprising amount of control when it comes specifically to education policy, and we're expecting that to stay the case.
Shelby Doyle is the Director of Communications for National School Choice Week, and it is something that we have talked a lot about, and we're certainly going to talk a lot more about it, I think, in the coming years under President Trump. So thanks for helping us understand that a little bit. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
It's 12:23. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Scott Catoon is in the studio, and he's the man in charge of TechNori, which has an event coming up. Is it over the weekend, Scott?
It's Tuesday.
Tuesday. Okay, next week. Next week. Is that the
31st?
All right. Well, welcome back to The Business Lunch.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So I want to talk about the event and what's coming up. You took over TechNori about, what, 8 months ago or so?
Yeah, it was May officially.
Okay. And one of the things I remember when you took it over, and I think we've talked since then, was that you wanted to really increase the participation of women in the events because they weren't there so much.
Yes. So the female participation as well as minority participation was like one of the main things for us. We now, and it's not a big like fanfare thing that we do. It's just something that I want people to notice when they go there is that our population is half women and half men roughly.
Okay.
And it's about 30% roughly minority compared. When you go on a stage, it should be the same way. We want our community to look that way. So it's been a big initiative for us, and we've hit it every month since June. The first one we did not hit it, made the promise in June on the Tribune, and we've bet it everyone. 50% of our stage will again be female represented, and roughly 30% will be minority represented.
You know, maybe I got a little ahead of myself, but tell everyone what TechNori is. What's it about?
Yeah, so TechNori has been around since 2010. The original point was to blow up the startup ecosystem in Chicago. We didn't have 1871 and these other things that you might have heard about now. But since then, in 6 years, we've had about 300 companies featured on our stage here in Chicago, as well as in a few other cities, New York, LA, Atlanta, a few others, Milwaukee. And they've gone on to raise about $260 million in venture funding. And they now employ approximately 2,500 people in the Chicago area.
But it's almost like a show, too.
Oh, yeah. It's a fun show. We bring a big keynote in. This event on Tuesday, flying in from San Francisco, is the Women 2.0 founder, Shahroz Sharnaria. And she's flying in from San Francisco to talk about what it's like to be in Silicon Valley with women in tech. And then there'll be five startup companies that will take the stage. They have 5 minutes to explain to the 500 or so people in the audience at Chase Auditorium what they are, why they're here, what's their mission, how they're going to accomplish that mission, and most importantly, what we in the audience can do to help them get there.
Oh, and tell me about that. Tell me about the crowdfunding and everything.
Yeah, so that's a big topic of discussion of late is the equity crowdfunding. The Title III of the Jobs Act, interstate crowdfunding is what people in Illinois know it as, enables any business to raise money. So instead of getting, you know, Kickstarter, instead of getting a sticker and a T-shirt, you actually get equity in a company. And so these.
So four, it used to be not that you had to be publicly traded, but you had to register, and it was very difficult to sort of buy into part of a company.
Yes, it
those
was very
rules have been weakening, or they've been loosening, I should say.
Yeah, they've been loosening. I mean, I call it the democratization of investing.
Sure, right.
Is the way to look at it. The ability to do it both sides, whether you're the investor or the owner, was so complicated that people just didn't bother.
Right.
Now with platforms like Republic in New York, which is who we use, anyone can sign up, put your bank account on it, and make investments $30 to $5,000, whatever you're
And then you get a little equity.
You do. And like a brief story on that is why we do this. You look at Oculus, which people know over the VR headsets. They basically raised a few million bucks a few years ago, and then sold themselves a few years later to Facebook for like $2.7 billion.
Still cash.
Yeah, right? So the average person contributed $500 to them. They got a T-shirt and an Oculus set. had they had an equity crowdfunding campaign and you put $500, you would have got a check for $30,000.
Wow. And so that's what's available at Technori?
Yeah. So this first one, it's the first time we've had this.
Okay.
Four of the five companies on stage are going to be raising. Two of them are Chicago-based and two are the entrepreneurs from companies people in Chicago know. One, Ellison Eyewear, already hit its minimum. So you can go, literally go get a ticket on technori.com, go to the showcase, and just right there from your phone, invest in these companies.
Wow. Okay, so where do people find information?
Information, just go to technori.com. The events page has all the information you want to know who's there and how to get there and buy tickets.
And of course, there's the highly successful podcast at WGNplus.com, right?
Yes, Technori. WGN. Yeah, we have Technori Live on WGN, which is awesome. People love it.
And I'm afraid we're out of time, but we should be discussing Marquette Villanova, Marquette Creighton, and...
Beat the number 7, beat the number 1. We'll see Marquette on Saturday against Providence.
You're a smart man. Good to see you, Scott
Katoon. You too.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Ian Schur is on the phone line from CNET. And, well, Ian, welcome to the Business Lunch. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Great. We have got a lot to talk about. I'm fascinated by this story out of California. I think it was California, about this traffic accident. The guy who was rear-ended is suing not the person who hit him. I mean, maybe he is as well, but is suing Apple. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. There is a basically a patent that Apple put out a while back, and they were granted in 2014, for a way to lock out the phone if it senses that it's in motion in a vehicle. And Apple never implemented it. They never put it into the phone. But this person is suing Apple because they said if Apple had actually implemented this feature, he wouldn't have gotten in a car accident and everyone would be okay. And so it's interesting because Apple is a very aggressive about putting patents out there. They file for a lot of patents, as we remember from the lawsuit with Samsung and also the one they happen to have with Microsoft a long time ago. They also like to defend their patents in court. And so this is a very interesting situation where that strategy of constantly filing patents has actually kind of backfired in a weird way.
Okay, so the story, the story says government figures suggest in 2014, 3,179 people were killed, more than 430,000 injured in crashes involving distracted drivers. That's a pretty remarkable thing. Now, but that, I mean, I guess it could be a number of distractions.
Yeah, you can't exactly blame Apple for those. I mean, here's the problem, right, is that as human beings, we are all very flawed. I think we can all agree on that. And the biggest problem we have is that when our phone starts buzzing at us, it's very hard to not want to pick it up and look at it, even if we're driving. And as human beings, we're also not the smartest people in the world. And what happens is that, you know, you sometimes think, oh, I can multitask while I'm driving. And the New York Times actually had an amazing series on this a few years ago. They won a Pulitzer for writing about the science behind why distracted driving is so dangerous and why our use of smartphones in cars is such a bad idea. And it's something that has spurred a number of legal pushes. There was actually a law passed here in California in January that was it implemented in January. That was a second law that they put on the books now that tries to stop people from using their phones in the cars. It's a huge problem.
Okay.
But now you've got Apple kind of pulled it into this weird way, right?
Right. And so the lawyer says we don't want cash from Apple. We want them to stop selling iPhones until this is fixed. I don't think that's going to happen. But so
unlikely.
If you're Apple or if you're a dad with kids, you know, if I'm driving my kids around or had been when they were younger, you know, their phones would likely be immobilized by this sort of detector, this motion detector as well, right? And that's a torpedo.
Yeah, I can't speak for why Apple never implemented it, but just guessing based upon having used GPS systems and whatnot who do have these mobilizers and won't work unless you tell it you're a passenger, is that this is exactly the problem. Right? You can't control what the phones, you know, the phones can't tell if you're the driver or the passenger. And it's not fair to the passengers to suddenly have their phones not working. And, you know, I could be in a train. I could be on a bus. And suddenly every time that it moves, I have to tell the phone, no, it's okay.
Oh, exactly.
And so there's a lot of reasons why this wouldn't happen.
There's also, there's some hypocrisy. I mean, you brought up the GPS system. Maybe hypocrisy is not the right word, but, you know, I bought a new car about 18 months ago, expressly because I wanted the nice touch screen on the car. I'd had an old car, like everyone's got this, it's time for me to upgrade to that. Well, you know, car makers are making these touch screens and all of that, those are just as distracting as phones, and we don't seem to be cracking down on those at all.
Well, we are on some level. The car industry is actually very... I've talked to many executives in the car industry, and they all say that they're very cognizant of the fact that there could be a lot of blowback if their cars are not intelligently designed. And even Tesla, right, which is the electric car maker here in California, they have received some flack over the fact that they have basically a 17-inch touchscreen in their cars.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's a problem, but. I look at it as the only real answer I think is going to come down to it is not controlling our devices or even teaching us to be smarter. It's going to be automated cars, right? A self-driving car removes all the concern about this stuff. And, I mean, I just have to be honest. Looking at all the coverage on CNET, the way that it's been, that I see these problems not going away, and the fact that many states, including California, keep having to write laws to stop people from just doing idiotic stuff in their cars, comes down to we're just going to have to stop people from driving, and that would be self-driving cars.
Hey, we do a lot of idiotic things in our cars. That's why we have them. Ian Scher is here from CNET. Another thing, I see that Facebook is moving on. They're changing sort of our news feed or the feed of what's trending. And this is really interesting to me because, you know, there's this idea that we live in a bubble and we're only following the news that we like, blah, 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 all of that. Facebook seems to be taking steps to sort of burst that bubble at least a little bit.
Yes. Well, so first off, on that bubble, if you go to Google and type in red feed, blue feed, the Wall Street Journal has an amazing graphic that they put up during the election showing you how different Facebook can be depending on what it thinks your political views are.
And so that's the point of it, right? That's the point of it. Before it would look at what you were reading or posting, and then it would sort of create the news feed for you.
It's incredible, and I highly recommend it, called Red Feed, Blue Feed. But the interesting thing is that Facebook is trying to respond to a lot of the criticism they've gotten based upon the issues around fake news and this bubble concern. And they have this thing called trending topics. It's on the right side when you're using the desktop app. It's one of the most highly valued pieces of real estate on the internet. And it's this list of stories, right? And it's actually generated based upon what you click on and what you do. So if I click on a lot of Justin Bieber stories, I'm suddenly going to see a ton of entertainment on there, and it may not be all hard news. So Facebook said they're going to revamp it. They've already tried revamping it a couple of times because they've gotten a lot of criticism over it. And this time they're going to say, look, it's going to be based on geography. So everyone around you is going to see the same feed of news stories on that right side, which is going to be different from what they were doing before. That might take away the echo chamber. The other thing they're going to do is that they're going to rely on headlines from publications that are trusted in that list. So it's going to be now, instead of they have employees writing these headlines or they rely upon, you know, Johnny Come Lately blog that doesn't have ethics or journalism standards, they're going to rely upon local news, trusted news sources to be the headlines that are used here. Now, odds are it's going to change again in the future because they keep changing it, but it's Facebook's way to try and respond to this amount of criticism they're getting. And let's be honest, there's a lot of concerns. 60% of Americans receive their news from Facebook.
That's an amazing, that's amazing to me.
A very small fraction trust it. That's the most amazing thing. Like 16% trust it. So they're seeing a lot of news on there, but they don't trust any of it. So Facebook has to solve this problem.
Yeah, because so they're not trusting news that's garbage because they're reading it.
Yeah, well, and that's the funny part. They keep reading it even though they don't trust it.
Right.
And look, I mean, we all kind of go through this in our lives, right? But what's interesting is that Facebook has exacerbated this. And when you have to remember who Facebook is, we're not just beating up on a tech company. This company has 1.8 billion people using it every month. That is larger than any country on earth. And so when you think about the power that comes from what you show them, how you shape their thoughts and ideas, all of these things, it's very, very important that Facebook takes very seriously their position in the world and what they're showing us and how this algorithm works. And it can't just be what it was in the past, which is, oh, you like a lot of entertainment stories. Oh, you like conspiracy theories. Let's show you more. Because that leads us down this terrible hole that we've gone down.
Ian Scherer, you can read more at CNET.com. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's 12:53. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Did you hear that? What language did you hear it in? Oh, Andrew Ochoa is on a phone line. He's the CEO of Waverly Labs, and they've created this sort of new earpiece that you can use when you're traveling overseas or talking to someone who speaks a different language and understand them instantly. Andrew, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Thanks for your patience. I know we had a couple of scheduling issues in the past, so I'm glad you're able to talk to us now. Tell me about this pilot. What is it that it does?
Yeah, so look, we're a tech startup here in Brooklyn. We're called Waverly Labs, and we are working on this earpiece that translates. It's called the whole idea here is if you and I meet and we speak different languages, we can simply pop in a pilot earpiece and be able to have our communication translated for us. As we speak.
And so let's say I'm speaking Spanish, you're speaking English, we put in, do these earpieces have to be coordinating with each other, or can they operate independently?
Yeah, actually the way the pilot translation kit is designed to work is it comes with two earpieces specifically for that use case. So if we meet, you know, and I'm and you don't have a pilot earpiece, I can just give you one of the ones that I have with me in my kit. And simply what we do is set the languages via the mobile app that we're speaking. The earpieces just translate for us.
I see. So I could take it to Spain myself and just wear the earpiece and then speak a little bit more fluently or understand more clearly what the people were saying to me in Spanish.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as a matter of fact, there's a lot of use cases. What's really interesting is that we hear people say they want to use it for travel or they want to use it for this purpose or that purpose. What's really interesting and exciting is when people say this is going to help them communicate with their loved ones or their in-laws who speak a different language.
Yeah, I would imagine that's the case. So who is it? Where are we on this? I know you had a couple of crowdfunding episodes or issues and you're moving beyond that. Or where exactly are you with the reveal on this? Is it later this year?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, so we launched the original campaign on Indiegogo last May. We've done extremely well. We've pre-sold over 20,000 units, close to $4.5 million. We're moving to our own website next week, as a matter of fact, for further pre-orders. But essentially, in Spain, as a matter of fact, since you bring it up, at the very end of February, we'll be there for Mobile World Congress and their other startup program 4 years from now for FYN, doing any first public demonstrations.
But it seems to me like, and I understand that with loved ones communicating and the more intimate sort of thing like that, but if this works with travel, it's going to be huge for you.
Yeah, it's travel, tourism, international business. The opportunity is immense. Incredible. We're talking to a lot of businesses actually that are really interested and intrigued by what we're doing, as you mentioned, in the travel, the hospitality, the tourism space. So this is going to disrupt numerous industries.
And you're starting with, it looks like, kind of the romance languages, but expect to branch out later this year?
Yeah, so we focused on mostly Latin-based, romance-based languages, French, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, along with English. But later this fall, after we deliver the first unit this summer, essentially, we'll start focusing on expanding the language services or language offerings into we're investigating now, but essentially Russian or Southeast Asian and Chinese Mandarin, Middle Eastern, Arabic, Hebrew, African, possibly.
It is. It's an amazing thing, Andrew. I wish you the best of luck, and you might well change the way we communicate in the future.
I appreciate that. Yeah, we'll send you one to test out.
Yeah, I would love one. I actually lead tour groups overseas, so that would be so cool.
What country?
We're going to go this year, Iceland and Ireland, so I don't need it so badly, but Spain, France. I've taken a group to Spain probably in a couple of years. I took a group to France last year, so. I think of the way it would work in my business, my little side business. I just think it would be huge.
it's going to be enormous.
All right. But listen, good luck to you. Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it. And I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.